thank you for coming this evening. My name is David Welch, and I'm a professor of modern history at the University of Kent. I'm also director of what's called the Centre for the Study of War, Propaganda and Society at Kent, which I established in 1994. Last year, some of you may have been to the British Library exhibition on propaganda, which I co-curated, and I wrote the accompanying book. And one of them, we decided to take a thematic as opposed to a chronological approach to propaganda, going right the way back to the, you know, Roman coins up to the present day. And one of the things that I wanted to pursue in the exhibition was images of the enemy. So that's what I'm talking about this evening. I want to say a few words about, in general, about sort of propaganda theory. That's right, Rick. Come in, yeah. I want to start by saying a few words about propaganda theory, and then I'll move on to say something about a number of examples, which I obviously I'll illustrate as well. But first of all, I need to sort of start also with an apology, because one of the... I'm showing a number of film material, television material. One of the TV clips that I wanted to show, I work on Apple, and we've got a Microsoft system here, and for some reason... one of the clips will not come out. You can hear it, you can't see it. And it's a very short clip, but I hope it doesn't spoil your enjoyment. But I can talk you over it anyway. It's pretty self-explicit. Okay, so let me start by making a number of general observations about propaganda and the role of the enemy in propaganda. Perhaps the most outstanding stylistic device in propaganda is the use of contrasts. Not only do strong contrasts contain a greater emotional intensity than the more subtle nuances, but they also guide the audience's sympathies with more certainty. And this aspect of propaganda is full of confrontation. It's full of confrontation between good and evil, beauty and the beast, order and chaos. And in each case, the contrast serves to force the individual into the desired and firmly established commitment. And in this ultimate purpose, propaganda is aided by man's psychological need for value judgments. Value judgments in simple black and white terms. And this is particularly so if a country is in the same crisis or war, when there is an increasing need for a simplification of the issues. In such a situation, the other side becomes totally malevolent, one's own cause indisputably just, and everyone gathers around the symbols of unity. So propaganda, then, I'm arguing, is at its most effective in times of uncertainty. And hatred is generally its most fruitful aid. In any society, a people cannot be kept too long at the highest level of sacrifice and conviction. Even in regimes that demanded relentless fanaticism, such as the Third Reich or the Soviet Union, some form of diversion was needed. Hatred of the enemy was manipulated to fulfil this need, as it is probably the most spontaneous of all reactions. And in order to succeed, it need only be addressed to the most simple and violent of emotions, and through the most elementary means. It consists of attributing one's own misfortune to what we might call an outsider. A frustrated people needs to hate, because hatred, when shared with others, is the most potent of all unifying emotions. Heine wrote, and I quote, "What Christian love cannot achieve is affected by a common hatred." Now, whether the object of this hatred is the Bolshevik, the Jew, the Muslim, or the Anglo-Saxon, such propaganda has its best chance of success when it clearly designates a target as the source of all misery or suffering, providing the target it chooses is not too powerful. The aim of propaganda is to provide the object of this hatred in order to solidify the feelings of hatred. So what I would like to do then is to show a number of examples of how different regimes depicted images of the enemy during the course of the 20th century. And I'll also be showing one or two examples from the 21st century as well. And what I'm trying to do is to use a wide range of different propaganda artifacts, posters, cartoons, leaflets, film, television, etc. Now, one of the most striking means by which the media has influenced social attitudes, changing or reinforcing opinions, has been through the use of stereotypes. And in a sense, that's what I'm talking about tonight. Stereotypes. By that, I mean conventional figures that have come to be regarded as representative of particular classes, races, and so on. It was the American social scientist Walter Lippmann who developed the term stereotype to describe the knowledge men thought they possessed. That is, knowledge based on myths or dreams. Lippmann believed that if he believed in the power of the myth or the stereotype to arouse popular enthusiasm. And he argued that abstract ideas and concepts like national pride are more real to the masses than actual realities. The French philosopher and sociologist Jacques Ellul noted in the 1960s, and I quote, "Each individual harbours a large number of stereotypes and established tendencies. From this arsenal, the propagandist must select those easiest to mobilize, those which will give the greatest strength to the action he wants to precipitate." That is, the propagandist, end quote. So, in this context, propaganda gives the individual the stereotype which he or she no longer takes the trouble to work out for himself. And it furnishes them in the form of slogans or labels. A recent example of this might be the manner in which, for example, asylum seekers have been depicted in various sections of the British media. The recognition of stereotypes is an important part in understanding the use of anti-symbols and the portrayal of the enemy in propaganda. And the enemy is of great importance in propaganda, for not only does it provide a target that can be attacked, but it also offers a scapegoat. Scapegoat, the easiest means of diverting public attentions from genuine social and political problems at home. And these stereotypes invariably come ready-made, having evolved whether consciously or subconsciously over a considerable period of time. And they frequently attach themselves to myths associated with other nations, races or groups. One only has to think about anti-Jewish motives in Nazi propaganda, or anti-Soviet motives in American propaganda during the Cold War to illustrate this point. And there are generally two kinds of images of the enemy that emerge. One, the enemy from within, and two, the enemy from without. Propaganda is normally concerned with the latter, particularly in times of war. However, I want to include both in this brief survey, and to show how the two can occasionally conflate. So I want to start then with images of the enemy employed during the First World War, for it's during the 1418 conflict that we witness governments taking their first tentative initiatives at using film propaganda to depict their enemies, and I'll show you an example of this later. The Tsar had famously dismissed cinema as, and I quote, "complete rubbish." But when war came, others took a different view and seized on the opportunities that this new propaganda medium offered. In Britain, the government could rely upon official and also commercial filmmakers to depict Germany in unflattering terms. And in a sense, Germany provided the perfect enemy. And whenever enthusiasm for war began to flag, there was an endless stream of German atrocities to strengthen national resolve. So the first image of the enemy I want to just discuss briefly is the so-called Prussian bully, the Hun. And the German invasion of neutral Belgium was the pretext for an anti-German campaign which rapidly mobilised widespread support among all sections of the population in Britain. And Belgium was depicted as a defenceless child or woman ravaged by some kind of brutal Prussian militarism. One only has to think of Remarque's cartoons to sort of illustrate this point. This is the... I could have used Remarque, but I decided to use Edmund Sullivan. This is the Prussian Butcher, a wartime cartoon by Sullivan, 1915, and it is the Angel of Mercy who is on the chopping block about to be dismembered by the bestial Hun. Of course, the bestial Hun signified by the traditional spiked helmet, the Pickelhauber. German atrocities in Belgium, real and imagined, helped to fuel the more lurid depictions of German as subhuman beasts. Similarly, in 1915, same year, this is a postcard, a British postcard, portraying the execution of Nurse Edith Cavell. And this was seen, of course, at the time as a sort of the ultimate barbaric act of a debased German culture in which the land of Bach and Beethoven give way to the music of death. Cavell's fate prompted a deluge of such images in British newspapers, cartoons, postage stamps, and posters. A note just on the piano there, the Pickelhauber game, perched on the piano. If you want to raise any questions about these, please do. I don't mind if you want to start.
What happened to this Miss Cavell? How was she with murder? She was just murdered.
She was shot by the Germans for helping Belgian soldiers.
Well, British soldiers too,
and British soldiers as well, yeah. And at that time we didn't have conscription until 1916. After the death of Nurse Cavell, recruitment, voluntary recruitment, absolutely soared.
Yes, do you mind if I take pictures of the things you come?
Not at all.
That's the Belgian flag, presumably, there, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. So, the theme then, we're talking about the Prussian bully, and the Prussian bully, the idea of the Hun, was taken up by Lancelot Speed. Lancelot Speed was an animated cartoonist, and in his animated cartoons, which were known as lightning sketches, he sought to ridicule the Kaiser and German military might. And these films proved to be a great success with British audiences. Speed's cinematic cartoons contained many topical references, which contemporary audiences would have been familiar with because of what disseminated in the British press. So in this brief extract, in fact it's a compilation that I've edited together, it's called The Prussian Bully, and it was distributed in 1915. In The Prussian Bully, the audience are shown the shelling of Reims or Hans Cathedral. Thought at the time, the Germans shelling of Reims Cathedral, thought at the time to be the height of German barbarism. And in an interview in 1914, prior to the showing of this film, Lancelot Speed revealed that an exaggerated drawing of Lord Kitchener's drooping moustache had provided the inspiration behind the image of the British bulldog, who would remain the implacable guardian of the British Empire, and could always be relied upon to eat the German bratwurst, a shorthand for German bratwurst. And we'll see these images in the film, after Arthur Coleman. Does improve the quality of the film. So this is Lancelot Speed, you see there. So he's always in front of the camera. You actually see him. These are so-called lightning sketches. And they would last between 10 and 15 minutes. Anybody recognise his drawing? Here's a drawing. Oh, now the Kaiser. The Kaiser. So these animated sketches will be telling a contemporary story that British audiences will be familiar with.
When will they show this?
In the cinemas.
In the cinemas.
Mm. Remember, the cinema moved from from being kind of essentially a working class to a much wider sort of phenomenon. An audience is apparently, there was reports in the press at that time, as soon as they saw Reims Cathedral, they started to boo and shout. Because of course it had been shelled by the Germans. This is 1916 rather, in September 1916 a campaign was waged in Germany with the specific intention of diverting attention from domestic hardships by stimulating hatred of the enemy, particularly Britain and the British blockade which had started. Posters were a cheap and effective means of disseminating such propaganda, and this is a typical hate poster which showed a picture of, it's interesting, he showed an ugly, snarling British military figure, curiously, in a sort of Scottish uniform here, astride an equally vicious bulldog. And the caption is, he is to blame. And it goes on to say, and I'll just paraphrase, if you still have to struggle and bleed, if you still have to go without, if you still have to be sparing with coal and light, if you need ration cards and official vouchers, these were maybe for clothing, if you still can't return to peacetime work, the main enemy is England. Therefore, remain united, stay strong, so that you can contribute to Germany's victory. So, kind of mild in comparison, but atrocity propaganda, of course, became a feature of First World War propaganda, particularly of the British. And after the war, a number of governments, particularly totalitarian governments, believed that they learned a great deal from British propaganda in the First World War. I want to move on to the interwar periods and what I've called the greedy gulags. So if the Hun and the perfidious Albion provided a good example of denunciation of an enemy without, the derogatory Russian term kulak denoted a very distinct type of enemy within. An enemy that the Russian Bolsheviks argued was engaged in wrecking the Marxist-Leninist project. Now just to recap briefly, kulaks were former peasants. They owned medium-sized farms as a result of the reforms which were introduced by the Tsarist Prime Minister, Peter Stolypin, in 1906. But after the First World War, once the Soviets and the Bolsheviks had come to power, Soviet propaganda depicted these farmers as greedy and standing in the way of what they referred to as the utopian collectivization. Because collectivization would take away their land, their livestock and their produce. The Bolsheviks, therefore, declared them as enemies of the people, and kulaks were left homeless and even without a single possession, as everything was taken from them, including their pots and pans. It was also forbidden by Bolshevik law for anyone to aid, dispossess kulak families. This is a Bolshevik poster of 1929. It's an anti-kulak poster from the 1929 campaign, which had been instigated by Stalin to liquidate the kulaks as a class. A fat, a greedy and selfish kulak is forced from the collective farm in this unambiguously hostile poster from this Soviet campaign against the kulaks. The text reads, "Down with the kulaks. Kick the kulaks out of the kokovs." The kokovs was the Bolsheviks' collective farm. And to the right, you can see that fist. To the right of the large fist is a quotation. The quotation is from, or it's attributed anyway, to Lenin. And it says, and I quote, "The kulaks are the most bestial, brutal, and savage exploiters who in the history of other countries have time and again restored the power of the landlords, the czars, the priests, and the Catholics." In other words, you can't feel sympathy for these people because they will restore the old order. And, I mean, just to put it in context, Stalin's collectivization led to large-scale famine, of course, during 1932-33, along with the deportation to the labor camps and the execution of, some historians have argued, between 6 and 10 million kulaks. On the 30th of January, for example, 1930, the Politburo approved the extermination of the Kulaks as a class. So here then we have an example, unlike the First World War, of a regime that depicts an enemy from within, not from without. So let's move on swiftly.
Sorry, could I just ask you something on that? Because it seems to be a major difference there is also that they're playing on envy, aren't they? That seems a shift from what we've seen so far. What do you think about the role of envy?
Well, I think, and of course we'll see that again when we go look at the Nazis, when we refer to the Jews as well. Again, it's a similar thing, an enemy from within. These people, they profit. These people are lazy, but they're making, big profits and things like that. So the idea of, the propaganda of envy, if you like, is one that, recurs in history.
It's a bit more subtle in a way.
It's more subtle, but it's also, it creates a scapegoat for serious internal problems. And of course, during this period, there was, astonishingly starvation that was taking place within the whole of Russia at that time. So, the Kulaks were used very much as a scapegoat for this. So moving then on to the Second World War, again, I want to go back to British propaganda. We've just seen Lancelot Speed's Lightning Sketches, and they contained rare examples of humour in British propaganda during the First World War. One of the features of British propaganda in the First World War was the lack of humour. One of the features of British propaganda in the Second World War was the way in which humour was so widely used. Now, I want to show a newsreel. It's a famous newsreel. It's a Goman British News. Well, the one I'm showing is from Goman British News, but it was actually also a film on its own right. It was made by somebody called Charles Ridley. And what Ridley did, he cleverly re-edited actuality film of goose-stepping Nazi soldiers at Nuremberg. And all the shots are taken from Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will, which of course was shown in 1935. And he takes these shots from Triumph of the Will and he transposes them to the popular tune of The Lamb of Walk. Some of you may have seen this. And he used the music because members of the Nazi Party called the tune, that is The Lamb of Walk, Jewish mischief and animalistic hopping. Now, the intention was to lampoon Hitler and his military might, his forces. The effect at the time, you may not find it so, the effect at the time was hilarious and ridiculous, but the fear of the enemy and his military might was very real, especially in 1941. Mass observation that was monitoring British propaganda throughout the Second World War found that this particular newsreel was one of the most popular during the Second World War. No sound. Remember when Riefenstahl's film, which is all these shots are taken from, was made in 1935, was shown throughout the world. The idea, the whole idea of Triumph of the Will, Triumph des Willens, was to show the power of Germany. It was a famous phrase at that time, Deutschland erwacht, Germany awake or reawake. So what Ridley is doing here in 1941, when this was a very real threat to the British, was to try and, as it were, not dehumanise them, but to reduce the, as it were, the frightening power by using humour. It's very clever, the editing.
the story about Goebbels is true.
Which one?
Larry watches and stormed out.
Because
watching this really angry. It's just like, you know, when you look it up on Google or whatever.
Oh, well, I think they were. I mean, in his diary, he actually does say that he says he was furious about it. Calvin Canty, a great filmmaker, of course, during the Second World War, used similar tactics to humiliate Mussolini. There's one, if you can see it, called the Yellow Caesar, which is very similar to this. In fact, in some ways, it's even more impressive. Incidentally, the reference to Schicklgruber, I don't know if you've got that, is that Adolf Hitler's father, Alois, was the illegitimate child of Maria Schicklgruber. They later changed their name to Hitler, so that's the reference there. Okay, well now, let's now go to Nazi anti-British propaganda. Remember, it was Britain that declared war on Germany in September 1935, and once Britain had declared war on Germany, the perfidious Albion came back into German propaganda, only this time, obviously, with very much a distinctive Nazi slant. And Britain became the object of hatred during this period in Nazi propaganda. And throughout the early part of the summer of 1940, as the struggle for the control of the skies over Britain took place, anti-British propaganda reached a new crescendo, claiming that it was only a matter of time before Britain's fate was sealed. Nazi propaganda tended to emphasise British hypocrisy and its plutocracy. Churchill in particular was targeted and mercilessly lampooned. One famous poster depicted him as an American gangster. It's a famous one. This is the one. It's a picture that originally, I think that's a Thompson submachine gun, and it was taken during a visit that he made to the coastal defences. I think it's in Hartlepool in July 1940. So this was intended to show kind of resolve and everything in British propaganda. The Nazis used this, and they showed this as, and they refer to him as the sniper, as an American-style gangster. So they used, as it were, a British piece of propaganda, subverted it without doing anything, and used it in German propaganda. And then they subverted it again when they decided to use this as leaflet propaganda over Britain during the Battle of Britain itself. So they used the same photograph that he's indicted for murder, this is a gangster, and there aren't that many that have still exist now, but there are still a few. Save at least your families from the horrors of war. Similarly, this is my postcard actually. This is a Nazi anti-British postcard of 1942. It shows a sort of beleaguered Churchill, like Admiral, aboard the ship of Britain. And Britain is surrounded by mines, and this Churchill figure is about to swallow a German bomb. The text, which is quite a difficult German, it is a play on words, but it translates as follows, and I quote, "For you, things are going to get really rotten. We're going to use a Stuka to shut your big mouth." Now, this was a card that was sent from Kassel in 1942. I have the original. I used it in the exhibition. On the other side, it's written by a citizen of Kassel, and it's to somebody on the Eastern Front, and they're trying to say that, which is true, that everything's okay, you know, everything's calm here. The irony, it's nothing to do with this talk about sort of images of the enemy, but the irony, of course, is that the fact that it was written in 42, and it talks about how things were so normal in Kassel, is ironic because the city itself would be largely destroyed by Allied bombs within 18 months. So, you know, it's turning this whole thing round. The fortunes of war will change, and it would be Kassel in Germany that would be receiving war punishment. Okay, so that's the enemy from without. While Britain represented the enemy from without, one was actually, that Germany was actually engaged in fighting in a conventional war, Nazi ideology had simultaneously identified an enemy from within, namely, of course, the Jews. Or more specifically, an enemy from without that had become an enemy from within. I was going to show extracts from the film of The Eternal Jew, or The Wandering Jew, the A.P. Yuda. Because I've got so much to get through, I decided not to, but has anybody seen the A.P. Yuda? It is the most virulently anti-Semitic film. I show it in my teaching, and you do have to sort of put it into context.
Is that the one with the rats in it?
The rats, yes. Yeah, and the kosher killing.
Long time ago.
Yeah.
Isn't there another film called
Yud Zeus? There were three films that were made in 1940 to help prepare the German population for the final solution. The first one was called Die Rothschilds, which showed you a British plutocracy, and it showed you how the Jews are taking control over British society and British banking. The second one was Yud Zeus, which shows you Marianne Ferdinand, who was one of the great German actors at that time, being placed a Jew in Stuttgart in the 18th century. And although Jews were bad, he assimilates into Burgenburg society, and he becomes very powerful, and he actually rapes a German woman, who then commits suicide. He rapes her because her fiancé is being tortured. She commits suicide because she feels disgusted and she's ashamed and everything. And then the citizens of Württemberg rise up and they hang to the Jew Zeus. And it was a film that all SS officers had to see. It's compulsory viewing. As indeed was the Ewige Jude. So the other two were feature films. This is a documentary film. And The Eternal Jew runs through the whole range of Nazi allegations against Jews. The film begins with scenes from the Warsaw Ghetto. And these scenes, which are, they say, are documentary evidence, were designed to show the reluctance of Jews to undertake creative labour. And it then continues the film with the migration of Jews and their attempts to assimilate within European peoples. You see an animated map showing how Jews, starting from Palestine, which it refers to as the spiritual centre for international Jewry, had diffused the world, which particularly it says in the 19th century, and I quote, with its vague ideas of human equality and freedom, gave the Jews a powerful impetus. And then we see this expansion of Jews is illustrated in a dense network over the map, which looks like festering sores. There then follows, and this is the point you were making, there then follows, in the film, an analogy between Jews and rats. It's an analogy which Hitler had first used in Mein Kampf. The film cuts to a sequence of rats devouring grain and scurrying in packs to fill the screen. They actually come straight onto you on the screen. The camera is in a rat run, and you see the rats running towards you. The commentary continues, and I quote from the film, comparable with the Jewish wanderings through history, remember we've just seen these so-called Jewish wanderings through history, are the mass migration of an equally restless animal, the rat. Wherever rats appear, they bring ruin, they ravage human property and foodstuffs. In this way, they spread disease, plague, leprosy, typhoid, cholera, dysentery, etc. They are cunning, cowardly, and cruel, and are found mostly in packs. And it ends, in the animal world, they represent the element of craftiness, a and subterranean destruction, no different from the Jews among mankind. And then it goes on. That's just the beginning of the film. Now, this was a film that was made in 1940, as I say, part of a trilogy of films to help prepare the German population for the Final Solution, which, of course, the Final Solution to a so-called Jewish problem. And what these films, and particularly Der Ewige Jude, were attempting to show was that there was a problem. There was a problem within. There was an enemy from within which had come from without. How do we explain this? Well, according to George Mosser, and I quote, "A myth is the strongest belief held by the group, and its adherents feel themselves to be an army of truth fighting an army of evil." Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister, maintained that the purpose of propaganda was to persuade the audience to believe in the viewpoint expressed by the propagandist. But what I would argue is that if propaganda is to be effective, it must, in a sense, always preach to those who are already partially converted. Let me give you a quote from Aldous Huxley, writing in the 1930s. He said, "Propaganda gives force and direction to the successive movements of popular feeling and desire, but it does not do much to create these movements." This is the crucial point. He goes on to say, "The propagandist is a man who canalizes an already existing stream. In a land where there is no water, he digs in vain. The propagandist is a man who canalizes an already existing stream. In a land where there is no water, he digs in vain." And it seems to me that the Nazi attitude to the Jews is an excellent example of this facet of propaganda. It cannot surely be argued rationally that anti-Semitism was a result of National Socialism, or that Goebbels' propaganda alone made Germans anti-Semitic. But the fact remains that the Third Reich was responsible for an attempt of genocide of unparalleled scope and brutality. And this situation may be attributed partly to the effects of propaganda itself, and partly, I would also argue, to the closed political environment within which that propaganda was necessarily working. Thus, when Hitler came to power, he needed the Jews as a sort of permanent scapegoat, this goes back to your point, as a permanent scapegoat on which those in the movement could work off their resentment. The Jew, therefore, was manipulated to fulfil a sort of psychological need for Germany. Nazi propaganda used the historical predisposition of the audience towards an anti-Semitic explanation for Germany's cultural, economic and political grievances in the 1930s. So the Jew then seems to me an excellent example of an enemy from within. Let me, stay with the Second World War, let me cite another example, but from an American point of view. What was called the Yellow Peril. American anti-Japanese propaganda, which you could also argue is another example of racist propaganda in World War II.
But the Yellow Peril was the Kaiser used that first, did he not? The Kaiser used the phrase the Yellow Peril first.
Yes, but it became a major feature in American propaganda in the Second World War. In the language of the filmmaker, Frank Capra, Frank Capra was a Hollywood filmmaker, very famous, who was brought into the American propaganda machine. And in 1942, he made a series of films called Why We Fight. In the first one of these, Prelude to War, this is what he says in the film. This is the narration. "This is a fight between the free world and the slave world." Now, this is a theme that would come back and haunt us during the Cold War, between the free world and slave world. Prelude to War, the first in the seven of these seven films, was an interesting film because it was essentially produced for American armed forces. These films were also supplemented by another series called Know Your Ally and Know Your Enemy. And later, both Why We Fight series and Know Your Ally, Know Your Enemy were then shown to civilian audiences in commercial cinemas as well. The Office of War Information, the OWI, which was responsible for official American propaganda in the Second World War, it first concentrated on the civilian front. But given the years of American political isolationism, there was a need to target those Americans who were joining the armed forces. And to this end, the US War Department spent more than $50 million on film production with the aim of providing soldiers and eventually civilians with a cause for which to fight. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is that in Prelude to War, right at the beginning, it pointed to the Japanese invasion of Manchuria in 1931. And it says that this is the start, this is the real start of the Second World War. This is what it says in the film. Remember that date, the 18th of September 1931, a date you should remember as well as the 7th December 1941. What was the 7th December 1941? Pearl Harbor, of course. So, it's actually going back. So, for on that date, it goes on, for on that date in 1931, the war we are now fighting began. So it's saying that the real cause of the war that the Americans were fighting in 42 were the Japanese. Going right the way back to 1931. So the Japanese surprise attack on Pearl Harbor provided the rallying cry for war even more than the sinking of the Lusitania had in 1915 and the way in which it crystallized anti-German attitudes in America. Now, as far as American propaganda was concerned in World War II, whereas the enemy in Europe was depicted by the United States as a sort of an evil regime, Mussolini and Germany, in Asia, the enemy was depicted as an entire race. In Europe, the United States fought to defend its allies against Nazi expansionist regime, which it claimed was motivated by a racist utopian ideology. Marvel's poster, extraordinary, I think, effective. They had these poster competitions. This one, the competition in 1942. Just bear that in mind. In the propaganda against Germany talked about fighting for freedom against an expansionist regime motivated by a racist utopian ideology. That's in Europe. In the Pacific War, Japanese expansion was accompanied by a belief of racial superiority. There's no doubt about that. The Japanese did see themselves as racially superior. But American propaganda was itself, I would argue, driven by the hatred of what they called the subhuman Jap. The Australian government's Department for Information launched a similar Know Your Enemy campaign, which was characterised by high emotional appeals and crude racial stereotypes that demonised the Japanese. In America, such feelings seem to stem from much more than simply vengeance for Pearl Harbor. They often reflected a kind of pre-existing racism, which had been reinforced by the Japanese attack. The animosity was demonstrated in the hysterical and totally unconstitutional deportation of Japanese Americans from their homes on the Pacific coast to internment camps, which demonstrated, I would argue, that the Japanese were viewed as an enemy from both within and from without. Interestingly, the OWI, the Office of War Information, generally sought to restrain rather than generate the more extreme attitudes, partly because it was concerned about the negative effects of racially based propaganda on Afro-Americans who were supporting the war in America itself. Hollywood, of course, produced a whole series of films that dramatised the Yellow Peril. Wake Island in 42, Guadalcanal Diary, 43, Bataan, probably the most infamous, 43, Corregidor, 1943, and Destination Tokyo, 1943. Bugs Bunny featured in an episode of Warner Brothers' Merry Melodies entitled Bugs Bunny Nips the Nips, where the enemy was referred to as Monkey Face, Slant Eyes, and Bow Legs in the cartoons themselves. So this is the Tokyo Kid. Now, as part of the effort by the, this is the U.S. Douglas Aircraft Company, in 43, there was a absenteeism was beginning. Are you too hot in the back? Is it getting?
I am.
It's really hot.
Can I just turn? People are, okay, so in the U.S. Douglas Aircraft Company were concerned about rising absenteeism. And they were trying to improve workers' efficiency and avoid waste. And the short-sighted, buck-toothed Tokyo Kid fronted a poster campaign. The kind of grotesque racial stereotype combined with comic book absurd. There's a kind of sense of danger there as well, the threat of danger, visible with the blood-stained dagger. The message here is that workers who rush to finish their shifts are implicitly a boon to the enemy. Wash up early, rush out the door, give Jap time for win war. So the idea is to try and stop absenteeism and for American workers to work a full day. Otherwise, it will lead to, you know, a Japanese victory. And so these posters then became distributed throughout America. Accessories and paraphernalia with a propaganda theme similar to this abounded. There were patriotic buttons carrying slogans such as Slap That Jap, Fight for the Four Freedoms. These are Roosevelt's Four Freedoms. Superman comics reinforced the same message specifically to small children, in which it says, I was going to show you the front page of the comic. Superman is on the front page of the comic and it says, Superman says it's okay to slap a Jap. Ashtrays were sold with pictures of a Japanese soldier in a rat's body and the slogan, jam your cigarette butts on this rat. Matchbox labels urged, hang one on Nippon, showing a US Marine beating a Japanese soldier. And in 1945, a number of atomic bomb games were even produced, the object being to tilt the game in order to simultaneously maneuver the bomb into two holes, labelled Hiroshima and Nagasaki. If you think I'm joking, there it is. So, again, an example of the enemy from within. Let me just move on, because I've got just a few more to show you. Let me move on briefly to the Cold War. I want to show you one. More subtle than we've come to expect. This is in the British Library exhibition last year. We used this, and it became the most popular fridge magnet of all British Library. This is the Soviet Union, and it's called the Weeping Statue of Liberty, 1968. Here we have symbols and counter symbols, very sophisticated. Unlike much of Soviet propaganda in the 1950s, and indeed American propaganda, this is a Soviet poster, and it subverts the traditional symbolism of the Statue of Liberty. It's a reference to, well, can anybody, 1968? What happened in America in 1968? Well, lots of things.
It's right, presumably.
But particular one, which was not race riots, but was more political.
Well, the execution of Roosevelt?
No. The Chicago's Democratic Party Convention, do you remember?
No.
It's a reference to the Chicago Democratic, remember this is 68, so this, it's highly contemporary. And the eyes, can you see the eyes?
Yeah.
Of the Statue of Liberty, what are they?
It's a face.
What do you say? Two policemen. Can you see what's coming out of one of the eyes? It's a truncheon. And it's a tear, you see? It's a tear. The Statue of Liberty is crying. The eyes become a policeman, and the truncheon becomes a falling tear. In lament for what the caption describes as, and I quote, it says, "Freedom, American Star." So, for their own party conventions, they beat up protesters. So, that's quite a sophisticated example. Now, the next one, this is where the apology comes in. This is called The Bear, 1984. And I've included this. It's a TV ad from Ronald Reagan's 1984 presidential election campaign. I've chosen it, first of all, because the Soviet Union is still being referred to as the bear and is still being identified as the enemy of the United States. And secondly, I've included it because it highlights shifting propaganda techniques. Reagan's blend of down-home charm and saber-rattling fitted the mood of the times, especially since the former president, Jimmy Carter, had appeared by comparison weak as a result of the Iranian hostage crisis and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. Indeed, one of Reagan's other poster and political campaigns on TV actually says, and I quote, "Do you think the Soviets would have invaded Afghanistan if Ronald Reagan had been president?" So, this is a TV ad, but unfortunately you can't see it, but you can hear it. Literally, I was going to say, blink and you'll miss it. So what appears...
There is a bear in the woods.
It's a bear.
For some
people, see a bear walking.
The bear is easy to see. Others don't see it at all. Some people say the bear is tame. Others say it's vicious and dangerous. Since no one can really be sure who's right, isn't it smart to be as strong as the bear? If there is a bear.
That's, you see this bear come up, and then you just see a man standing in front of the bear, and then it flashes to Reagan, and it says, you know, Reagan, 1984 presidential campaign. So the subliminal message is very much that, you know, Reagan, the Cold War is still with us. Soviets have gone into Afghanistan under the previous president. Reagan will stand firm against the...
You said that was 84.
84.
Right. It was the first time he was elected, wasn't it?
Yeah, the first one, yeah. So he was juxtaposing himself as the man of strength against Jimmy Carter's apparent weakness. Two final bits, visual ones, and I have to say these are quite violent. And they're quite shocking in some ways. We're talking, that's very much the enemy from up without. These are the enemy from within. And they're called NIO, which is the Northern Ireland office. They're the anti-violent shorts, they were called. One's called Lady, and one's called A Wanna Be Like You from an Arab. Harry Chapin's song in 1974. It's a very interesting context. We didn't see them. This is Northern Ireland in the late 80s and early 90s. We're going into the 1990s, and it's an attempt by the Northern Ireland office and the British military to cut through the sectarian divide by identifying, I quote, the men of violence as the enemy. The men of violence are the enemy from within. So these are TV shorts, a bit like Reagan's, you know, very, very, all very, very, and actually employed a company to this day will not concede that they made them in Scotland. The British military were trying to change their propaganda image. And these TV shorts were produced specifically for Northern Ireland, shown just at prime time, 9 o'clock. They were never shown on the mainland for reasons that you'll probably identify. And linked to them is a confidential line. A confidential line, you remember, had been set up in Northern Ireland. And the slogan was, don't suffer it, change it. So here you see two examples. All the modern techniques of advertising were employed, targeting specific groups and individuals. And it was intended to shock the population of Northern Ireland into the desired effect, or the desired, rather, action and the desired action comes in the slogan at the end. So these are violent. This one is targeted squarely on Irish women.
Both sectarian sort of terrorist groups, particularly the IRA, have
the British military in Northern Ireland said that the number of Irish people phoning the helpline trebled after these. And there were reprisals. The IRA in particular said that if Irish people called, watching these, it's almost a bit like some Nazi Germany, listening to the British, then there will be all sorts of repercussions. What's interesting is that the military who were behind this, they'd realised that they'd got their propaganda wrong, so very wrong, because they were still using, they saw it as a counterinsurgency war, but they were still using the experiences of Malaysia and the Mau Mau, etc. in Africa. And Northern Ireland was very different. And so you suddenly see in the sort of the mid-80s, you suddenly see the older officer class being removed from British television screen and a new younger officer class coming up who were much more media savvy. And they used Sony Ericsson for this, although they still deny it to this day. And the idea was to take the military out of this so the military are not seen. It's the people themselves. It's the enemy from within. They've got to do it. So, but this is essentially British military propaganda. Okay, I'm just coming to an end now, so I'm very patient. So, in effect, you could say that they were effective, although we can't measure them. I had to get military clearance to show these in the late 1990s because they were not allowed to be shown on the mainland. I just want to say something briefly about PSYOPs, psychological warfare, and leaflets. Now, we've come right the way up to modern technology, all the techniques of modern advertising. I want to throw all this into disarray now. It was President Reagan who was responsible for revitalising what's called PSYOPs, American PSYOPs, in the 1980s, psychological. At a strategic level, this involved flooding the Soviet bloc with Western propaganda, especially after the arrival of satellite television and new communication technologies such as video cassettes, fax machines, and eventually mobile phones. Now, following Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in August 1990, President George H.W. Bush was persuaded to incorporate PSYOPs as an integral part of the first Gulf War. This is what's called Operation Desert Storm, you recall, 1990-91. As a result, PSYOPs sort of came of age again, been used in the First World War, used in the Second World War. Operation Desert Storm became associated with modern media technology. It was often referred to as a media war. However, this is the irony, one of the oldest forms of propaganda devices, the humble leaflet, was also extensively employed by PSYOPs. More than 29 million of them, weighing approximately 29 tons, was disseminated by the Americans between the 30th December 1990 and the 28th of February 1991. 29 million leaflets in less than 2 months dropped during Desert Storm. And during this time, 69,000 Iraqis surrendered or deserted, many more than were actually killed. And the ones that deserted or surrendered were invariably carrying the so-called safe conduct passes that had been a feature of leaflet propaganda and psychological warfare in both the First and Second World Wars. So the idea is, you drop it, I'll show you, and then you have a safe conduct pass. If you hold this up, you will not be killed. So, in the ostensibly high-tech environment of the Gulf War, the leaflet, the crude leaflet, was actually used to great effect. Now, I'll just show you a few examples. This is Saddam Hussein. He's targeted, you see, as the enemy from within. It says, "You are unarmed." This is a propaganda leaflet dropped over Iraqi troops by American PSYOP units during Operation Desert Storm. It continues, "Your supply lines have been cut off and you will not be receiving any more. Saddam does not care about your end, and he has deserted you. Put down your arms and join your other Arab friends in the love of peace. So, very, very crude pieces of propaganda. These are not sophisticated. This could have been, you know, there were more sophisticated leaflets dropped in the First World War. Slightly more advanced. This is the Iraq War in 2003 in Afghanistan, and it continued where Operation Desert Storm had left off in terms of PSYOPs. It says the coalition is here to put an end to the oppression caused by Saddam. Again, it's identifying to the Iraqi people that he is the cause of all the suffering. And this is coalition leaflet dropped over Iraq, encouraging Iraqis to listen to information radio. So remember, they had Commando Solos, these are these massive great airplanes, which still exist, still flying over, 24 hours a day, sending out leaflets, but also sending out radio propaganda. And they were encouraging Iraqis to listen to what's called information radio. And finally, one that I like, this is the British one. We are the British Armed Forces, follow all your orders and you'll not be hurt. So that's a safe conduct pass, British style. So.
With instruction too, yeah.
No? Fun?
It's like it's instruction, first do this, then...
Yeah, exactly. These are to follow the orders. So first of all, you know, you lay down your arms and then you hold it, and then you come out with the leaflet.
It's just missing that bit, so you can just... Drop your arms and surrender.
And I like the Union Jack as well. Okay, let me bring this to conclusion. Just a few final thoughts. So what I try to show is that images of the enemy come in many shapes and forms. Some are humorous in order to deflate the enemy's presumed power. Some are brutal to elicit feelings of hatred. Different techniques are used by the propagandists to construct what I would call an identikit picture that corresponds to stereotypes and myths that have often been deployed over a considerable period of time. These don't just suddenly emerge. The propaganda image of the enemy must, however, remain, I would argue, of sort of stylized simplicity. The message must be expressed in a way that it does not invite too much discussion. Its appeal is intrinsically emotional and excludes all sort of discussion in that sense. And such propaganda also reinforces one's own sense of national, racial, or ethnic identity, and it strengthens commonly held symbols of unity. One other point that I would mention, it's important to remember that the images of the enemy that we've seen here were not constructed in isolation. The film, the poster, the leaflet, the cartoon, the radio or the television broadcast, and now of course the internet, which may be the exception, they would not have been viewed in a vacuum. Each formed only one aspect of a wider and concerted propaganda drive, in which all the available means of communications were generally employed. So the case studies I've shown are historical, and for the most part, the stereotypes are of their time and have since withered, if not necessarily died. Today, and I'll finish on this point, today many people wonder how audiences in the past could be so gullible in accepting and acting on such propaganda. But it seems to me the principle is timeless, and the construction of, in quotes, enemies, both real and imagined, is perennial. Many of its incarnations have been employed on both sides in what, since 2001, the West has called the War of Terror. A human tendency to think of them and us is always liable to be exploited by those with the means and the power to do so.